First, though, time for Correspondence Report.
Thanks, Hugh. Welcome to the program. The ABC's Middle East correspondent, Eric Torchek, has just moved to Israel from Papua New Guinea. His former posting was in a country that's considered one of the world's most dangerous. But people in Jerusalem don't necessarily feel any more secure than those in Port Moresby, and a new firearms policy from Israel's government has started a fresh debate about public safety.
West Jerusalem is very quiet on Saturdays. It's Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, a perfect day for a morning walk on streets with few cars. It was on my first Shabbat in the city that I saw my neighbour with a gun, a young man walking down our street with a religious book in his hands and a pistol in his back pocket. He didn't acknowledge us as we passed, and I wondered why he needed a gun while walking to the synagogue. After that, I started noticing guns everywhere. People riding motorbikes with a gun on their hip. People waiting for the bus. A different young man walking up and down our street with an assault rifle, looking in people's rubbish bins. And then I visited an office of Israel's Interior Ministry, which was actually in the West Bank settlement of Har Homa. I passed through a metal detector, and upon entering the office, saw a young Jewish man with a tiny baby wrapped to his chest and a large pistol strapped to his waist. Clearly, the metal detector was only to stop certain people from carrying weapons inside. People who live in settlements on the West Bank, those communities built in Palestinian territory in breach of international law, are among the Israeli civilians who can apply for a gun license. Others include former army officers and people who live near Israel's borders, or its so-called separation barriers, the large walls and fences Israel's built between Palestinian communities and Israeli ones. Israel's Public Security Ministry is easing gun license requirements so that anyone who's completed the Israeli Defense Force infantry firearms training would become eligible. It estimates that will lead about 40,000 more people to get a permit. Currently, there are 145,000 permit holders, not including police, soldiers, and security guards. But given most Israelis must complete military service, the changes will increase the number of citizens eligible to carry a gun by hundreds of thousands. The Public Security Minister, Gilad Erdan, has also decided Israeli Defense Force officers and commanders will not have to return their weapons and licenses when they're released from duty. His justification for these changes is the hope that armed civilians will be able to stop terrorists. Civil rights groups fear the move will increase violence rather than reduce it. Welcome to the war zone was one politician's response. An umbrella group of organizations has formed to oppose the changes, saying there are already too many weapons in public spaces in Israel. They say the evidence from the United States, and indeed from countries like Australia, shows that increasing the number of firearms leads to more gun deaths, and decreasing the number of guns reduces gun crime. There are already lots of weapons on Israel's streets, because security services are deployed everywhere. Armed pairs of police race around the city on motorbikes, soldiers with assault rifles guard public spaces and stop you while driving to check your passport. Then there are the young Israelis doing their military service who take their weapons home with them on leave. This can lead to some strange sights, such as the young woman I saw in a short skirt and high heels at the shopping centre, her army rifle slung over her shoulder. All this weaponry reflects the preoccupation with security in Israel. It's a hallmark of the country's political and social discourse, which refers to terrible violence in the past and the constant need for vigilance now. There are still almost daily reports of attacks on Israelis, although many of them are in the West Bank, where the ongoing struggle for land also sees Jewish settlers attacking Palestinians. My former home, Port Moresby, was last year ranked the sixth most dangerous city in the world for expatriates to live in. Crimes like carjackings and robberies are common. There are occasional riots. Infrastructure is poor and services unreliable. But despite the well-publicised security problems of Papua New Guinea, I rarely felt unsafe. PNG is a land of smiles, not suspicion, and I never saw guns at the supermarket. In Israel, services are reliable, the government is efficient, and many of the hassles of living in a poor country are absent. But there are a lot more guns in Jerusalem than in Port Moresby. It shows that wealth doesn't bring security, and while more guns might make some people feel safer, they haven't had the same effect on me. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Torchek for Correspondence Report.
After two decades of economic strangulation and political oppression, Zimbabwe could be on the cusp of a new era. For the first time, a presidential ballot paper was issued without the name Robert Mugabe on it. The new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has promised prosperity and peace. But on the streets, it's clear that Zimbabwe's economic rehabilitation will take decades. ABC correspondent Siobhan Hinyu travelled to Harare and filed this report.
The streets of Zimbabwe's capital are full of activity. Men and women in suits walk through the central business district headed for their office jobs. But a few blocks away, women and men sit on the curb selling fruit and vegetables. They might have 30 tomatoes to sell, or 20 avocados and a handful of garlic cloves. If you want to buy a fresh tomato, you can pay in US dollars, or Australian dollars, or euro, or even Chinese yuan. That's because Zimbabwe doesn't have its own currency anymore, after hyperinflation under Robert Mugabe led to billion and trillion dollar notes being printed, before the local currency was deemed worthless and jettisoned altogether. The government has started minting and printing a new currency, but it's not recognised anywhere else in the world, and so foreign currency is preferred. It's not uncommon to see hundreds of people queuing outside a particular bank before opening time. A rumour will have circulated that that bank on that street has cash today, and people will patiently but desperately wait to find out if the rumour's true. Usually it's not. The cash crisis here is crippling. Even people lucky enough to have relatives overseas who can wire home money, well, they can't actually get that money if there's no cash to withdraw from the banks. The well-worn cliché is that Zimbabwe went from being the breadbasket of Africa to the continent's basket case under the rule of Robert Mugabe. In 37 years at the helm, he oversaw the forced seizure of land from white farmers, which contributed to drastic economic decline and international sanctions. Hyperinflation, corruption, drought, famine, and mass unemployment bedeviled the country. Like the fruit and vegetable vendors, more than 90% of the population works in the informal economy, doing what they must to earn what they can, outside any formal industry and without paying any tax. There was disappointment among supporters of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, when its presidential nominee, Nelson Chamisa, was outpolled by the incumbent, the ZANU-PF party's Emmerson Mnangagwa. When Mugabe stepped down following the military coup in November last year, it was Mnangagwa who stepped into the president's role. Although they come from the same party, Mnangagwa has promised a break from the past. It has to happen for Zimbabwe to have any hope at economic rehabilitation, any hope of having sanctions against it removed. Europe is gradually lifting sanctions, but the US is not. In fact, Mnangagwa and several of his party chiefs are subject to financial and travel sanctions. Mnangagwa is popularly referred to as the crocodile in Zimbabwe. That's a nod to his political cunning. His opponent, Nelson Chamisa, accused him of vote rigging in order to win the recent elections, and he launched an ill-fated legal challenge to have the results overturned. At Mnangagwa's inauguration ceremony in Harare's main stadium, tens of thousands of people filled the stands. Some had been bussed in from surrounding districts, as the president's support is strongest in rural areas. In poorer country areas, about a quarter of the people I saw walking on the roads or tending to fields or families were wearing colourful Mnangagwa caps or T-shirts or skirts with his portrait printed on them. It's not that they necessarily support him, they just appreciated the new, free clothes. The mood in the sports stadium for the inauguration was noisy and joyous, but not quite unbridled. It wasn't quite grand final fervour, it felt more like a quarter-final, with the people towards the back of the stands more interested in the free entertainment than cheering on their new leader. The international community and some Zimbabweans have their reservations about Mnangagwa, about whether he'll be able to rock the boat enough to cast off deep-seated corruption problems in the country's political, administrative and governing bodies. But from city to country, from white farmers to black artists, at the inauguration ceremony and even among opposition supporters, there was one unanimous and positive observation. Nearly everyone I spoke to told me that for the first time in two decades, they were experiencing genuine freedom of speech. You could campaign without being beaten, one woman told me. You can discuss what you want to discuss, said another when I asked. Zimbabwe is a deeply religious country. Christianity and God are invoked by both sides of politics. But religion has also been a much-needed salve through years of hardship and repression. It's played a large part in the ability of ordinary Zimbabweans to survive the worst years of dictatorship. The churches here have also been accused of collusion in politics, but for the faithful, worship has been an outlet that's allowed them to keep their voices ringing, to express their sorrows and their hopes. And with a newfound freedom of speech now reaching the masses, it might be possible in Zimbabwe for those hopes to start outweighing the sorrows. This is Siobhan Henu in Harare for Correspondence Report.
Let's head to China now, a country that's unquestionably on the rise, from an economy that's still well and truly outpacing developed countries to a growing military asserting a bigger role in world affairs. In fact, everywhere you look, China's booming. So why is it so common to hear members of its middle class say they want to get out and to live overseas? Our China correspondent, Bill Birtles, has been taking a look.
It's been a rough few months in China. Firstly, the value of the yuan has taken a plunge. The government fixes the value of the Chinese currency, and many here believe the central bank is pegging it lower to help exporters cope with the new American tariffs. Since dropping 9% in June, the yuan has since stabilised. But the tariff war isn't going away, and plenty of people fear it will drop lower and hurt their ability to buy imported goods and travel abroad. There was also a major scandal about the safety of vaccinations. Regulators found hundreds of thousands of tetanus jabs for children weren't actually effective. It was a huge story that spoke to the worst fears that many people here have about the safety of medicines and food. And it was around this time that I started to hear Chinese friends speak of a desire to go abroad. Lucy Liu from Shanghai has taken the next step. With her husband, she's engaged a migration lawyer to look at the options to migrate to Australia, where she has a cousin. I asked the mother of two small children why she wants to leave China.
Even though China's economy is very good, in our opinion, there are other aspects where we feel the flaws and the gaps are still quite large.
She says the hyper-competitive education system, known for rote learning rather than critical thinking, and air pollution are her major concerns.
Especially in winter, sometimes in a bad month, I won't dare leave the house with my kids more than twice. Inside, we have the air purifier running 24 hours a day. This is a big factor for me. The other is education. Schooling in this country doesn't let a child breathe. The pressure is too much.
Last year, about 28,000 Chinese nationals were granted permanent migration visas in Australia, slightly down from a peak 7 years ago. The government has been tightening the number of skilled and sponsored visas it grants. Lucy Liu says she's optimistic.
I'm a little bit worried, but I still believe so long as we comply with the conditions, there's good reason to be positive about it.
Getting permanent residency outside of China is the long-term goal. But actually becoming an Australian seems to be further down on the list of priorities for many potential migrants. Quinty Cho moved to Melbourne 4 years ago with her family and is on a work visa. She's planning to apply for permanent residency, but not citizenship.
We're Chinese and our family and friends are all in China. If we apply for an Australian passport, we'll have to get a visa every time we go back to China. That's a big hassle.
For this reason, it can seem like some well-off Chinese migrants see countries like Australia as convenient places to live without wanting to make the full commitment to become a citizen. And though almost a third of Chinese-born migrants to Australia reported in the last census that they spoke not good or non-existent English, the relatively large diaspora makes it increasingly possible to get by in major cities without needing to speak it. But Lucy Liu says that's not what she wants for her family.
A lot of people feel living in a Chinese suburb is just like being in China. There's Chinese shops, Chinese characters, Chinese people everywhere. I think there are pros and cons for me, but I've got friends who tell me that if you really want to live in a foreign country, you should live somewhere with local people.
China's rise is being summed up domestically with a political slogan, the Chinese dream. You see it everywhere. But it's clear for quite a substantial number of the country's middle class, they dream of having somewhere else to call home. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing for Correspondence Report.
In the past week, top executives from two of the world's largest social media platforms have testified before the US Congress. We heard from Facebook's chief operating officer, Sheryl Sandberg, and Twitter's chief executive, Jack Dorsey. And the hearing comes after claims that Russia and other foreign actors spread misinformation and propaganda ahead of the 2016 US presidential election. The executives acknowledged they were unprepared to act against fake accounts and political meddling.
We were too slow to spot this and too slow to act.
We found ourselves unprepared and ill-equipped for the immensity of the problems that we've acknowledged.
But there was also an empty chair. Google wasn't there. To discuss the hearing and how the social media platforms are responding to these issues, I've spoken to someone who's perhaps covering this more closely than most. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large for the technology news website Recode. She's also a columnist for the New York Times, and she's worked for the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. I began by asking her about Google's absence from the hearing.
Well, they invited first Sundar Pichai, who's the CEO of Google, and also Larry Page, who's the founder of Google and also the CEO of Alphabet, which owns Google. And neither of them wanted to come, and they wanted to send in their stead their lawyer, Kent Walker, who's a very a major executive at Google, but not them.
Broadly speaking, what were the main issues canvassed at the hearing?
Well, it was all about election interference, essentially, and some other things about Russian bots and, you know, fake information and things like that. But it stuck largely to really serious topics as opposed to other hearings that sort of veered off into all kinds of different ways. You know, right now, some conservatives in the United States think that Twitter is biased against them, which is just ridiculous. So it focused on serious issues, which are this election meddling and how the platform is being misused by malevolent actors.
So what are Facebook and Twitter doing to stamp out election meddling at the moment?
Well, they've got a couple of things they have to do. They've got to remove fake accounts, which is something they've been working on, which are accounts that are just made and bots and things like that, so that are just fake. And so they've had to do that. The other is to make political advertising transparent of who's buying it and where it's coming from and who, you know, who's manipulating it, essentially. They should probably make a lot of advertising transparent, but that was a real problem. It's transparent everywhere else that it's dissipated, but on the internet it wasn't. And so that was an important thing. And then the last thing is to deal with the fake news problem, which is just all over the place, and especially on those two platforms.
You've been following this for some time, no doubt. Hearing from Facebook and Twitter that, you know, this is a problem and we need to deal with it, in a sense, that's not new. We've been hearing that for some time. Are you convinced that the platforms are taking this issue seriously?
Oh, they're taking it seriously. This is the first time they've appeared at Congress, and I think they're going to have to take some hits in their finances and other areas because of it. Eventually, you know, this is not something we can tolerate in any country, you know, and it's been abused in other countries, and so it's a problem. And so they've definitely got to figure out a way to make this not an issue on their platforms. And it's a very big, it's a very important thing to the government of the United States that's not Donald Trump, and it's a very important thing to everyone across the globe, I think.
So what about the question of regulation? What else can Congress do to actually make sure these social media platforms are doing everything they can to stop something like election meddling?
Well, they can do lots of things. They can do, there's an election security law that sort of sits there. There was an honest ads law that was there. There's an internet bill of rights that they could put in about privacy. You know, California is a state that's been very aggressive too. They just passed a much more stringent, not as stringent as some people would like, but a relatively stringent privacy policy. And so if you're going to see the states do it, you eventually will see the federal government doing it.
Kara Swisher, editor at large for the technology news website Recode. And you can hear a longer version of that interview on the Correspondence Report podcast. It's available on your favourite podcast app. That's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Thomas Ariti. My thanks to technical producer Kem White. Join us at the same time next week for more thoughts and stories from the ABC's foreign correspondents. Now it's back to you, Hugh.
Thomas, thank you.